Today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about a global system on which all life depends, and you may be relieved to hear that it isn't the economy. For our look at photosynthesis, I'm joined by Dr. James Boyer, Associate Director for Teacher Professional Development at the New York Botanical Garden, and Dr. Amy Litt, the Director of Plant Genomics and Cullman Curator at the New York Botanical Garden. I'm very pleased to welcome you both to the show. Hi.
Hi, Leonard.
Hi, Leonard.
So, Amy, in 25 words or less, as they used to say, what is photosynthesis?
Photosynthesis is a process by which plants are able to harness energy from the sun and convert it into a form that all other living organisms can use. It forms the basis of essentially all life on Earth. And specifically what plants do is they're able to use the energy from the sun, they trap it and convert it into chemical energy, and that energy is then used to produce sugars, and those sugars then form the base. The sugars hold that energy, they capture that energy, and that the sugars then can be used either to form more complex carbohydrates or to provide energy to produce proteins and things like that.
And they also sop up carbon dioxide to kind of clean the air for us?
Yes, exactly.
Now, Jamie, I understand that photosynthesis can be approached from a number of angles, that biochemists might look at the process one way, while scientists who study light and electrochemical processes might view it differently. Can you help us understand both ways of looking at photosynthesis?
Well, sure. When someone looks at photosynthesis, it basically can be viewed as sort of a materialistic way in which there's, you know, gases and liquids that are coming together, and those are producing sugar, which is then being used by the plant. But if you look at it as a energy kind of concept, it's, you know, energy from the sun coming in, and it's exciting electrons, and these electrons are actually then being used, and the whole process is basically building energy from it's an energy kind of concept going through it. But there's, you know, you could view it as either way.
Jamie, you brought a plant along. Amy, did you bring the plant?
Yes, I brought a
For our discussion today. How would you describe the process from the plant's point of view?
Well, the plant, of course, doesn't really care about the rest of us. It's only trying to live and grow and survive and reproduce.
It's a pretty plant. What is it?
It's a miniature pepper plant, actually. These are small little pepper fruits there.
And it's interesting. Some of those peppers are red, and some, and I'm assuming that the red ones are ripe.
Exactly.
And the other ones, which have either no color or different colors, are in various stages of ripening.
Exactly. So they start out a whitish or greenish color, but then as they become mature, they turn the reddish color, which presumably attracts, for instance, a bird that would then eat the fruit and disperse the seeds.
Now, why wouldn't they be green just like the leaves?
There are
vegetables and fruits that are green.
Of course, that question actually can be answered on several levels. On a purely chemical level, there are pigments in these red ones that are not present in the green ones, but also the red ones will be attractive to birds, and the birds will then eat the fruits and they'll carry them away and deposit the seeds. The plant does not want the birds to eat the green ones because the seeds are not ripe yet. So when the seeds are ripe, the fruits will then turn red.
And what function do the leaves serve, and are needles and fern leaves the same as the kind of broad leaves that we see on this plant?
Well, the leaves are, you know, primarily involved with, you know, capturing the sunlight. They basically, leaves evolved in order to capture sunlight to be this flat blade thing, and to also bring in the carbon dioxide, the CO2. And so there's the water coming up from the roots and through the stem and into the leaves, and then all of this is basically being combined in order to make the sugar. So really when it comes down to it, photosynthesis is, you know, pretty much an ancestral process. So, you know, whether you're looking at a conifer needle or you're looking at a fern frond or a magnolia leaf, they're all roughly doing the same kind of process.
But I would think that the needles on a fir tree, usually in a colder climate, mm-hmm. or the needles on a cactus, usually in a hotter climate, mm-hmm. would be less efficient than the leaves on this kind of plant.
Well, you know, there's a trade-off for any plant, given whatever environment it's in. You always have to bring the environment into the whole scheme here. So like the cactus, obviously, may be efficient in its own sense given in its environment, and you may have conifer needles, which are great, adapted for cold Arctic climates. So, you know, there's always a trade-off of efficiency. going on here.
Actually, could I just interject one thing about the cactus in particular? The needles of a cactus, the spines of a cactus, don't actually photosynthesize. In a cactus, the process of photosynthesis has been transferred into the stem. And so, in fact, there's a whole evolutionary just transference of the function there.
So are there other places where photosynthesis takes place where it isn't in the leaf?
There are actually some orchids that have roots that are able to photosynthesize. Stems quite commonly photosynthesize, especially in succulents. Anything that's green.
Mm-hmm. What about algae and bacteria? Are they going through pretty much the same process?
Green algae, certainly. All types of algae and a particular group of bacteria, in particular called cyanobacteria, we call them blue-green algae sometimes. They have photosynthesis very much like plants that we're familiar with. And other types of bacteria also have very different forms of photosynthesis.
Well, do bacteria have chlorophyll?
Well, blue-green algae do have chlorophyll. Other types of bacteria have other pigments that substitute for the chlorophyll. They're purple bacteria, green, I think, as well.
Mm-hmm. The chloroplasts are the places in the cells where photosynthesis actually takes place. So it's not always in the leaves. You're saying that it can be any place in the plant.
Yes, stems are very common. If you think about many of the things that grow around here, wildflowers or flowers in your garden, if the stem is green, that means the stem is able to photosynthesize also.
Does that mean that some plants are more efficient than others? Is it based on where the chloroplasts are located?
Well, it's not necessarily based upon where the chloroplasts are. I mean, it does play in a part. There are certainly plants that tend to be more efficient. But once it comes back to the environment, you know, some may be more efficient and some of the most efficient photosynthesizers tend to be the algae that are in our tropical oceans, you know, in the top meter of water. And they're amazingly efficient, so much so that they make almost too much sugar. They're secreting sugar out of them, and there's other organisms that just feed on that sugar.
Although we also rely on them for much of our oxygen, don't
correct,
we?
Yeah. In fact, that's where we get most of it from.
Are perennials more efficient than annuals?
Well, it's almost a difference in strategy going on here. So you basically have, for the perennial plants, you have plants that are very concerned because the adult plant's coming back next year. These plants are trying to make as much energy as possible and store it away so that when they come back the next year, where the annual plants are basically putting all their energy into making as many flowers as possible, fruits, drop those seeds because that adult plant's not coming back. So it tends to be the reason why we have all these pretty annuals in our garden while we buy them. It's because they have so many pretty flowers.
We're talking about photosynthesis on today's Please Explain with Dr. James Boyer and Dr. Amy Litt, both of the New York Botanical Garden. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Okay, I mentioned chlorophyll, and years ago we even had toothpaste with chlorophyll, although I'm not sure what that did other than make me feel like I was doing something good. That was being green before green was the thing to be. But what does chlorophyll do in all of this?
Well, chlorophyll is the primary pigment that captures the energy of the light. And there are actually several different forms of chlorophyll. The most important one is what we call chlorophyll A, which is found in all the way from blue-green algae all the way up through our flowering plants. And it is a green-colored pigment, which means, of course, that it reflects green light. It absorbs mainly red and blue light.
But why is it green?
Because we
want it to absorb that red and blue light?
I think the question is not so much why is it green as why is it not absorbing green light. The colors that we see on anything are the result of the wavelengths of light that are reflected back at us. Excuse me. So these red fruits are reflecting red light back at me. And leaves are green because the chlorophyll does not absorb green wavelengths, it reflects them back. The red and the blue are much more efficient for exciting these electrons in this chlorophyll molecule. And so those are absorbed by the chlorophyll, and the chlorophyll then passes that energy through a very complex series of reactions that end with the formation of a number of molecules called ATP. And ATP is sort of the energy currency of all cells. Our cells are full of ATP as well. And the ATP stores the energy, which can then be used in other reactions, in this particular case, the forming of the sugar.
Now, anyone who's gone to the botanical garden knows that there are lots of different greens out there on the plants. Does that tell you anything? If you, if an expert looks at a plant and sees a more bluish green, a more a brownish green, whatever, would that reveal something about the plant?
Well, I know, well, like one example for that is, you know, like if you look at the top of a pond, there's sometimes a lot of plants that are growing on top, and people will say, oh, that looks disgusting. Look at all that scum. And, you know, sometimes it is a flowering plant. It could be duckweed. And it sometimes has a Kelly green color to it, where if it was maybe a polluted pond, has a lot of runoff, pollution runoff. It may be algae, the cyanobacteria, as Amy was mentioning. And they have more of a bluish green. And that's probably, you know, the flowering plant would have a combination of chlorophyll A and chlorophyll B, where the bacteria wouldn't have.
There are also accessory pigments. There are other sorts of pigments that contribute to the overall color that we see. There are red-colored pigments and yellow-colored pigments as well.
In recognition of what's already happening north of the city, why is it that the leaves are changing color now?
Well, the plants not only have the leaves not only have chlorophyll in them, but as I was saying, they have these other pigments, the carotenoids, and which are yellow, for instance. And as the fall comes on and the days get shorter and the temperatures drop, the plants, especially deciduous trees and things, they stop photosynthesizing for the winter. They sort of pack down their metabolism for the winter, and the chlorophyll dies off. And the result of that is that the reds and yellows become the predominant colors, and so we see those instead. In addition, actually, sometimes when plants are under stress, they produce red pigments called anthocyanins. And so at this time of year, those will also tend to accumulate. And so we see these beautiful colors. And if I might, I'd like to say that if people would like to see the progress of fall at the New York Botanical Garden, they can go to our website, which is www.nybg.org.
Why is it that the plants, that the leaves look so much more beautiful outside of the city? We go through the same weather changes that NIAC goes through in Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine.
Well, you know, there are a fair amount of things. You know, on the garden grounds, it certainly seems like the trees certainly change, just similar to what's going on up at the Catskills and all that stuff. It can be the species that's going on. You know, we plant a lot of things like ginkgos and things like that on our city streets, which just go from green to yellow. So, you know, the brilliant colors of the maples, which like it colder, so you find them further north, and it seems like sugar maples are moving further and further north. With
so it's simply that they have maples
different,
and we don't.
Yeah.
Our number here is 212-433-9692. We're taking calls, and Clayton from West Babylon. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I had two quick questions. One is, I know that when it's runoff from fertilizers and nitrates and stuff, a lot of times get algae blooms, and we hear that it depletes the oxygen in the water, which sounds opposite. The second thing is, how is chlorophyll related to hemoglobin? I know they function in a similar way, but I was wondering how they're related chemically. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Well, at least the answer to the first question is that basically as you have these nitrates and phosphates that run off into the water, the algae does bloom. It takes it up, and it's certainly taking in CO2 and giving off oxygen. But then as those nitrates and all those things basically die down, all that algae is then going to start to die. And during the decomposition process, that really starts to take the oxygen back out of the water.
As far as the other question goes, I have to admit I'm not totally certain of my answer on this. Hemoglobin is a pigment as well, and both hemoglobin and chlorophyll are very complex carbon and hydrogen containing structures. Hemoglobin, of course, has an iron molecule at its center. I believe chlorophyll is a copper at the center. I'm not entirely
it's
sure.
Magnesium.
Magnesium. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
And we go now to Amy from Chelsea. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
It's Arnie.
Oh, Arnie. I'm so sorry.
I was wondering if we could use chlorophyll as a solar collector by pumping high sugar-producing algae through a transparent coil, either plastic or glass, and run it on rooftops and perhaps make a skyscraper of them.
Sounds to me like if you can convince an investor, you really have a good idea there.
And then take the sugars as they're produced, feed them into a yeast where they turn them into ethanol.
Would this be just too inefficient? Would we need too much surface to do something like that?
Actually, there are a lot of
people. Isn't that what Earth is doing to some degree anyway?
There are a lot of people, particularly I think in Japan and in the East, who are actually looking at using algae to produce biofuels. I think a little bit more directly than that, actually, but it's definitely being explored.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said earlier that photosynthesis is the key to life on Earth. When did it start?
Of course, we don't exactly know, but there's some evidence in rocks about 3.5 billion years ago. There's some chemical evidence as well as fossils of structures that look like they could have been similar to our current blue-green algae.
So until that time, nothing was living, and we didn't have as much oxygen.
We definitely didn't have as much oxygen. It wasn't for a few more billion years that oxygen really started to accumulate. There were some things that were living there, but they got their energy actually by breaking down other chemicals rather than from the sun.
We go now to Ven from Manhattan. Hi, Ven. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Not all geographical regions have fall trees with brilliant colored foliage in the autumn. Can you tell me what chemicals in the soil give the leaves their brilliant colors? Because in certain geographical regions, the leaves are just dark brown.
Yep. The question, I guess, is that how important is the soil that the plant is growing it?
Yeah, why is fall so spectacular in New York State, sort of that kind of? Well, you know, it certainly has to do with the species of plants that we have. We have, you know, four seasons here in the northeast of in the temperate areas. And in certain areas of the world, you're certainly going to have areas where plants can drop their leaves, but maybe they just go from green to brown, so in tropical areas. But it really is the amazing. It's probably less to do with the soil and more to do with the geography of where we are, the changes in seasons and the species that have adapted to those.
Well, you can grow any kind of plant you want at the Botanic Gardens because you have greenhouses and
conservatory.
So, is that do you see every kind of chlorophyll possible? You see every kind of green possible just walking through those greenhouses?
I would say probably a pretty wide range of them. Yeah. Certainly, yeah. There are things that even at the height of their photosynthetic season, their leaves are still reddish or multicolored.
And then there are some plants that are green all year round.
Exactly.
Sure. And is that because they have they've evolved to continue photosynthesizing 12 months a year?
Precisely. A lot of things in the tropics, they don't drop their leaves ever. Some of them do in the dry season, but a lot of them have leaves year-round, mm-hmm. and they photosynthesize year-round.
And then evergreens as well in colder climates.
Yes, although I think evergreens don't actually photosynthesize as much during the winter.
So, I mean, solid ice isn't going to be able to be used by the plant, so it just gives it an advantage. If there is a little bit of warmth in February, they can get going a little bit quicker than the broadleaves, but more successful up in Canada than here.
We go now to Ronald from Manhattan. Hi, Ronald. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks so very much. For allowing me to speak. I was wondering about oxygen. And you know, I would think, given, you know, my limited education from basically in school, they always told us that plants were the source of all oxygen. And you hear on TV all the time, the Amazon is the lung of the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I figure that the only source that I know of, at least from what I believe I've been told or heard, is the oxygen aspect. And yous are almost indifferent to it. I mean, what I'm trying to say, you spoke about it so lightly. Oh, yeah, it makes oxygen. Yeah, it does. You know, I can't, you know, even though all these things you're describing are so bad.
Ronald, are you asking for an apology? Is that what you're asking for?
Not indifferent to plants, believe me. Ron.
Well, I do want to say one thing in clarification. Of course, we're not indifferent to the oxygen. We wouldn't be here. But the actual primary purpose of photosynthesis really is to produce the sugars. And in a chemical sense, the oxygen actually is what we would call a byproduct. Mm-hmm. It's, of course, a very important one.
Well, we care a lot. Well, we care about both because the sugars are important when we eat the plant.
Exactly.
And the oxygen is important because without it, we can't breathe. So, but let's talk about the Amazon for a moment. Mm-hmm. And because we are seeing places like the Amazon, these huge areas which have so many plants, they're shrinking and they're being destroyed. have we seen a fall off on the amount of oxygen on Earth? We've also just been polluting our oceans, which are a major source of oxygen.
Well, I haven't heard of anybody finding actually a drop in oxygen levels. Once again, it sort of comes back to those tropical oceans, you know, that 70% of our Earth's surface is covered in ocean, and then, you know, a good chunk of that is this algae that's in our tropical ocean. So, you know, I'm sure if everything was defoliated from the Earth, it'd make a difference, but that algae really is doing an amazing job of giving us oxygen.
So far, we still haven't screwed that up.
Right.
Mark from Atlanta. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, this is Mark. I'm in Atlanta, and a few of us were listening on the internet, and we were curious how if roots were able to photosynthesize, how can they do that without getting actual direct sunlight?
That's a really good question. Yeah, that's a very good question. These are orchids that actually don't grow with their roots in the soil. A lot of orchids are what we call epiphytes, and they grow perched on top of other plants. They're not parasites, but they just use them as sort of a place to grow. And they wrap their roots around the branches of the trees, and so their roots actually do get light.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Does that answer?
They're not typical roots.
Yeah, okay, great.
Thank you, Amy.
Sure, you're welcome.
Thank you so much for calling us, Mark.
Bye-bye.
When did we first understand that there was this process called photosynthesis?
Well, you know, it looks like people were certainly thinking about this for a long time, and
people figured out that plants were doing something.
Well, they realized they were doing something, at least, you know, in the 1600s. But, you know, it's almost a similar concept to like how almost young elementary school kids think today. Is back then people thought that plants get their food from the soil, and that's a big misconception. They actually, you know, make their food in their leaves. So it wasn't really until much later, until about the mid to late 1700s, that people started to get the idea that there's CO2 coming from the air, and that's really the main backbone here that's making the sugar, and it's, you know, water being involved here, really just the hydrogen from the water.
But don't they really have two systems? What I remember from school is the xylem and the phloem, and
right.
Similar to the system that everything else relies on, and then the other one creating photosynthesis.
Well, the xylem is bringing the water, moving the water around the plant, so bringing the water up from the roots to the stem to the leaf. The phloem, that's the breathing part. Well, the phloem is the job to move the sugars then around to wherever it's needed, so maybe down to the roots or to young growing buds.
We thank all of you who've called in, and my great thanks to my two guests, Dr. James Boyer, Associate Director for Teacher Professional Development at the New York Botanical Garden, Dr. Amy Litt, the Director of Plant Genomics and Cullman Curator at the New York Botanical Garden. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show today.
Thanks, Leonard.